So based on some of the discussion that I heard earlier this week, and also the desire to have some pedagogical talks, I thought it'd be nice to give a brief introduction to why the challenges of studying slowly running theories using lattice gauge theory methods. And then Daniel will give a presentation of some ongoing work that he has of a toy problem where, because it's a toy problem, maybe we can do a really good job. And so we'll hear about his work. Is that, did I get that right? Okay, good. All right, so the problem that we're most interested in right now for the phenomenological reasons of Technicolor is to consider the theory of SUN gauge theories, non-supersymmetric, with NF massless flavors. Flavors in the fundamental representation. You can there you also consider theories in higher representation. Everything I'll say is more or less can carry over, but this is a concrete example. And what I would like to do is draw a picture that shows the running gauge coupling. So we have alpha as our running coupling as a function of energy scale mu, and it's asymptotically free provided the number of flavors is less than the number where you lose asymptotic freedom. And let's see, I want to draw one reference point here. We assume there's some critical value for the coupling, that if the running coupling exceeds that critical value, then it will trigger spontaneous chiral symmetry breaking, and the theory will break and confine and all of that stuff. So we assume, you know, so then setting aside questions of scheme dependence and everything like that, we just assume there's some notion of a critical coupling here. And then the idea is that for some number of flavors in F, the theory will run to some fixed point. We can call that alpha star, which is less than alpha C. And this is a theory with NF flavors. And then for the theory with NF minus one flavors, the flow is very similar. It runs a little bit faster. And then at some point, it exceeds the magic value of alpha C, and then the theory confines and breaks chiral symmetry. And we can, at some maybe scale, we'll call that lambda C where that happens. And this is a theory with NF minus one flavors. So we change the number of flavors by one. And so this would be a huge success to find on the lattice, because we would then be able to say NF minus one is less than NF critical, the critical number of flavors that indicates the end of the conformal window is less than NF. Now the main difficulty of these theories is that when you cut the theories off with some UV cutoff, let's say around here, I'll call that lambda UV, that in this region the theories are both slowly running. And so in a lattice context, we're always going to be working with UV cutoffs that are not way up in this asymptotically free regime. And so all of the theories we're going to be studying are intrinsically slowly running theories. And somehow we have to decide for a given, since we don't know where NFC is, if we're comparing theories at two different NF, is the theory that we're studying on a lattice the type that flows to a strongly coupled infrared fixed point? Where strongly coupled here means of order one, because it's assumed that this critical coupling is an order one coupling, not an order infinity coupling. Or is it going to be something like this, which ultimately would confine in the far infrared? Okay. Now, one of the problems with one of the usual ways in which we do lattice gauge theory studies is we usually need to put in small mass into the action in order to regulate the small eigenvalues of the Dirac operator. So we usually do the theories with the small mass. So one question is, what happens when we perturb this theory with the small mass? And so what we're going to do is we're going to put a small mass in the theory at the UV cutoff. We'll say m of lambda UV is equal to little m. And again, we're going to assume, or maybe we, in the lattice context, we will adjust our lattice parameters of the theory that this lambda UV is in this regime where we're slowly running. And since we're slowly running, we can therefore assume that alpha at lambda UV is, you know, less than but basically the same as alpha star if the theory has an infrared fixed point, or this could, you could think of this as maybe alpha c. So it's very close to either the fixed point coupling value or the critical value. And because it's very slowly running, we're going to assume that the anomalous dimension of the mass operator as a function of scale doesn't really run much either. So it's basically close to the value of the anomalous dimension of the mass operator at the fixed point, if the theory has a fixed point. Now, if you assume this, then the running of the mass is pretty simple. It just says that the mass is a function of scale, runs like the mass at the UV, and then it's parallel running. Up here. Okay. And so eventually you expect there will be some scale, which I'll call capital M, where the running mass becomes of order the energy scale itself. And at this scale, we expect something interesting to happen. First of all, this scale should be much less than lambda UV. And at this scale, essentially, the fermions are becoming heavy, and they should decouple from the dynamics of the problem. And so the theory will no longer be determined by this careful balancing of screening and anti-screening between fermions and bosons, but should the bosons, the gauge bosons, should take over, and we all know the pure gauge theory confines. So at some point, so this running mass at some scale will cause the fermion screening to become weak and the theory will confine. So I'll draw a new picture. Okay, here's alpha, here's mu, and okay, here's lambda UV. Here's where lambda would C would be in this theory, which is the so-called walking theory. And here's our alpha C and our alpha star. And the theory looks pretty much the same. And then the small mass will start kicking in here at lambda UV. And then at some point at some scale, capital M, both theories will show very similar behavior, which is some behavior I like to call induced confinement. Now, the expectation is, for what this theory looks like, it's not going to be a pure gauge-like theory. Because although the quarks are heavy, they're not infinitely heavy. And it's not going to be a QCD-like theory, because although the quarks are not infinitely heavy, they're not light either. So if you want to think of it in terms of QCD language, I imagine this is a theory where the quarks are heavier than strange quarks, but lighter than charm quarks. They're just sitting there at the confinement scale. But we, in this sort of picture, we expect that there will be some spectrum of states. The states are labeled by X, and that they will be to leading order just given by some order one numbers times this induced confinement scale M. And of course, if you just solve this set of equations, we know that m goes like little m to the 1 over 1 plus tau star. Okay. So, if you want to study the infrared of this theory that has induced confinement, it looks like all that happens is you vary your bare parameters. You choose your theory by choosing the number of colors and the number of flavors. That gives you a value for gamma star. You adjust your UV cutoff to be in the slowly running region. And the only other knob you have is the bare mass. You vary the bare mass. All it does is control the location of this induced confinement scale relative to your UV cutoff. But the theory that lives at this in the infrared is essentially just some spectrum of states, and all of the states appear to have a scale sort of set by this induced confinement scale. In particular, if I look at the ratios of two states, you know, let's say two baryons or a meson and a baryon or maybe a blue ball and a baryon, whatever you like, the expectation is that this will just be to leading order some constant ratio. And so the idea is that somehow there's a whole tower of states that lives here, color singlets. And the one knob that you have, the bare quark mass, just moves this tower up and down. But the details of the spectrum are somehow fixed. And so, since if we're working in a calculational context where we have a theory with a small mass and we see in the infrared spectrum, is there any way to use this spectrum to try and distinguish whether if we take the mass to zero, we would end up with a theory that looks like this with an infrared fixed point, or a theory that would have confined on its own anyways without a mass? Okay, so now we have to add one new wrinkle, which is everything I've said to you up to now is takes place in an infinite volume. Now, when we do a lattice calculation, then one of the first things we ask is, you know, how much computer power do we have? Which is basically a function of money. And then that tells us how big a box size we can do. So given the amount of computing power we have, we choose a box size and a lattice spacing. And then this is our volume, or this is our number of sites. Let's say to the fourth power for the number of dimensions. And this is just related to lambda UV over lambda IR, or IR cutoff. So that's just a pure function of money. How many lattice sites on a side can we afford? That's a function of how big the computer is. And then once we do that, we then have to adjust our bare coupling to fix the UV cutoff of the theory. Now, one of the wrinkles that is often not thought carefully enough about, even by the lattice practitioners, is when you're working with a very slowly running theory, the ability to choose a desired UV cutoff is actually a fine-tuning problem. And the simple argument is saying, if I make a small but finite change in the bare coupling, that gives me a small but finite change in the renormalized coupling. I can say alpha. But you can see from this flow that any small change in the renormalized coupling is a big change in scale. So the slower the theory runs, the harder it is to tune your coupling to get a desired scale. And actually, if you're not careful, in the lattice context, it's very easy to tune your system so that you're on the wrong side of the infrared fixed point, if there's an infrared fixed point. So you have to be very careful when you're trying to tune the system to have a normalized coupling which is close to but just below the IR cutoff. I'm sorry, the IR fixed one. Okay. So that's a wrinkle that's often not appreciated. But let's assume that I did the fine tuning. Now the situation is pretty clear. Hopefully I have a really big box, and I'll just draw 1 over A, my lattice spacing here, that's my UV cutoff, and 1 over L is my infrared cutoff. And at the UV cutoff, I'm going to have a bare parameter, my bare mass, little m, and I'm going to search for the presence of this induced confinement scale, capital M. And by varying little m and observing the shift in the location of capital M, I'm going to try to induce or infer what this anomalous dimension of the mass operator is. And as long as there's no intrinsic confinement scale around, like in the case of this locking theory, then this should give me presumably a lower bound on the anomalous dimension of the mass operator that you would get at the IR fixed point, provided that you can make, you know, 1 over L like this in whatever box size you've got. Now, for the most part, we're working with box sizes that are like 32 sites or 48 sites on a psi. So in terms of getting this separation of scales, it can be challenging. Now, but the issue is we want to be able to distinguish these two different cases, which means in order to do that, we want to find a theory that also has this intrinsic confinement scale built into it in the massless theory. Now, how do we distinguish that? It means we have to bring in yet another scale. So now we want to look for a situation like this. So naively, it says if you had a big box here, in order to do this study, you need an even bigger box here, because you want to be able to start with some lambda c in the middle and then vary your bare mass and show in this region I can trigger confinement prematurely by decoupling the fermions. This will get me the gamma star, the effective gamma star of the locking theory. But then I can keep dialing down my mass, and at some point, this other physics will take over, the real confining physics, and then the mass down here is just a small correction on that. So an example would be, let's say I look at the mass of, let's say the pi meson, which would be the Goldstone boson of the theory if it was spontaneously broken, compared to, let's say, the mass of the lightest glue ball, well, maybe not glue ball states, let's say the nucleon stable state. If it's if the masses of these states are rising just because of the presence of the bare mass, this induced confinement picture, then this should be more or less a constant order one number. But if at some point there's some mass value and such, and this would be the region where, you know, lambda c is much less than my induced confinement scale, and at some point I should be able to find a bare mass where the would-be induced confinement scale, it falls now well below the intrinsic confinement scale, and I should see Goldstone boson-like scaling. So this is pictures kind of a holy grail for us if we had huge amounts of computing power. Now the problem is lots of people are trying to produce a picture like this, but it's not clear that we have the computing power to do it. Okay, good, I'm on time. So what do we do now? The idea is that somehow is there a way that we can at least deal with the box, finite box size corrections. Can we deal with the fact that one over L will maybe be smaller than the mass scale of confinement, but not dramatically smaller? Or maybe even of order, the mass scale of confinement. And so initially you could say, well, let's imagine it's a small correction, then it's pretty easy to understand what's going on. You would say, my intrinsic confinement, or my induced confinement scale, capital M, in a finite box would be something like that same scale in an infinite box, and then small corrections, which I can just write as a power series. M infinity L plus E2
question.
How do you know a polynomial and not exponential? It could be. Those are corrections that you might not be able to get. But here the assumption is if your box is big enough, there's just small corrections there. Actually, the exponential is the exponential arises in a certain Again, if it's exponential, if this is small enough, you can just expand it to power zero. I'll just say it that way. Whether you can resum this into an exponential is an open question. Most people, you can in, let's say, the context of Kara perturbation theory where you have a model like that. It's not clear here that you do, but also I'll explain in a little bit that you don't necessarily need to or care. Okay.
Don't understand what your answer to David's question. So this is supposed to be the finite volume corrections to something like a meson mass in this theory, which has ultimately produced a mass. Well, at least you have particles. Now you're
saying you have particles
or not.
Well, here I'm assuming that the particle states arise in this context that the box size is large, but it's just a small perturbation. So I'm assuming that the states arise just because the fermions get a dynamical mass.
But ultimately, either you have an infinite volume, you have massless excitations that are presumably Goldstone bosons, in which case in finite volume you have power corrections, which you've shown, or you don't have Goldstone bosons and you have exponential.
In either case, because I'm working in a theory of finite mass, there's no Goldstone bosons in either case. In this picture, I drew it. In this picture, I'm assuming that I've decoupled the fermions before the dynamics has had a chance to trigger chiral symmetry breaking on its own, if it was ever going to do it on its own. In this case, the finite mass has decoupled all the fermions for me, and then it's just the pure gauge dynamics itself that drives confinement.
Good.
But that doesn't mean there aren't still states made up of these fermions. I can certainly make plenty of flavored states, isotriplet states, and they'll have masses of order the confinement scale, but they won't be Goldstone bosons because they're made of moderately heavy quarks. So,
but are we assuming the box size is large compared to that intrinsic confinement?
So I'm still assuming I'm working in this kind of limit.
So then I would really expect that the corrections are exponential, because we think of them as a loop of some of these low-energy particles going around the loop, and that's...
Yeah, it's the tricky part is whether is how, about in this picture, is how strongly bound are these quarks into these states? Because if you want to assume exponential, you're usually assuming that this state, the let's call it the nucleon, right, is propagating, all three quarks are going around together in a state that you can call the nucleon, and you're just counting winding of this. The problem is that when there's as much energy in the constituent quark mass itself is in the binding energy of the particle, it could be that they're fairly loosely bound, and it could be that there's no problem having, you know, one quark go that way and one quark go that way, or something like that. Those don't sum up to exponential in the same way.
But then you're not in a regime where I can regard finite volume effects as small corrections.
Yes. Well, it depends. It depends on how loosely bound they are. Because then the finite volume
bound is really the same thing as saying that physically this bound state is a big squishy thing.
Right.
And if your box size is comparable with the size of that bound state, this isn't some nice controllable.
Yeah, the question is, the bound state itself may be a big, the question is the relative size of the bound state relative to the size of the quarks that are in the state, something like that. Is it well-defined quark states that are sort of loosely bound positronium, or is it something more tightly bound like a QCD-type hadron? I mean, that's why I'm sort of hedging here, I don't know. But the real issue is, in this case, I kind of really don't care. If it's some exponential, fine. I want to be in a regime where I'm just picking off the leading, I'm expanding the exponential and picking off the leading term.
But it's not an exponential in the inverse of ML. I mean, that series doesn't sum to an exponential nicely.
Okay. Well, it is an exponential in ML, because basically ML is the same as if I were to write M pi L or MNL or something like that. Because I'm just basically assuming that the mass of the state, whatever it is mainly proportional to the mass of the number of constituents that are made up in it. So in that sense, I think it would sum to an exponential. Okay. This is just a minor point. I don't know. My main takeaway here is I wanted to show you that one could try and do this type of small correction. And I don't know, people have tried it. But I wanted to get to the last point, which is something that we would call hyperscaling, or in lower dimensions just called finite size scaling, which is just to notice that this could be any arbitrary function. And if I make everything dimensionless, you would say L times some state, mx, this is dimensionless. We would write as L times cx, and assuming whatever the function is, I can power series expand it in this way. I'll just do that for example, m infinity, 1 plus zx1 over infinity L plus. And all you really do is you just say that this is some dimensionless universal scaling function of the observable. It's observable dependent, but for each observable there's one universal scaling function, and that universal scaling function is a function of this dimensionless scaling variable that you write as L times M infinity, which is just L times M to the 1 over 1 plus gamma star. And so to make this work, what you do is you make a plot. You compute a bunch of spectrum of a bunch of different states, and then you put them on a plot, L times MX versus M. And then, well, I can even plot it versus L times M over 1 plus gamma. And the idea is that what you do is that you measure these states, the energies of these states, on a bunch of different box sizes for a bunch of different masses. And then you vary the anomalous dimension, and then you try to get them all to line up on some curve, something that's called curve collapse in the literature. So the symbols, this would represent one volume, and hopefully there would be more quantities computed on another volume, and then you'd have yet a third volume. And it's important that they kind of overlap. And this method is successful if you can find a value for gamma star such that all of the data points line up on a universal curve. You don't even actually care what the universal curve is, although you can use arguments like this to argue what its asymptotic form should be. And that would be a goal, or that's a method. And so people have tried this, there's some level of success. But at the end of the day, you don't know whether you can, if you see something that looks like finite size scaling, you don't know whether this scale is lurking around in your problem and you haven't reached it yet. So the only choice that you have is to keep pushing this induced confinement scale down as far as you can, and try and decide whether it's going to eventually go to a finite number, or at some point real intrinsic confinement kicks in and all of a sudden a state that was no different than any other state suddenly becomes a pseudo-Goldstone boson and starts going to zero. And so that's the situation we're in. There's plenty of people that have produced data that looks like this. Maybe it's, but it doesn't really look flat, it kind of looks like this. So now the debate is this just some correction to a higher anomalous dimension, so some UV physics thing, and eventually it will go like this, plus could this be a little bit of finite volume effect mixed in, or is really eventually this thing is going to dive down to zero? And I don't know, we're arguing about what's happening up here, and we don't know ultimately whether this thing is going to go here or dive down. So that's the issue. Okay, I'm 5 minutes over, so. Good. So I hope that was a good introduction to the problem that we're dealing with in trying to study slowly running theories on the lattice.
Okay. So.
Yeah, this. Oh,
okay.
And this one.
So, what basically George told us is that there is this parameter space for lattice calculation of these models, which is the lattice spacing, the quark mass, the volume, and the amount of money you have. And in the last say 3 or 4 years, both of us were working on this topic in the last 3 or 4 years. We were trying to solve this problem by here going to the zero limit, here going to the zero limit, here to the infinite limit, and this taking to infinity. And this didn't quite work out for the reason George was saying. But all these difficulties that he was saying, this was really took years and years of kind of experimenting and trying to figure out why things are not working, until finally I think now, exactly what George said, I don't understand why these are so difficult. Because initially, everyone was very excited in the lattice community. We're going to study something like beyond QCD, beyond the standard model. We know all about QCD on the lattice, so this is going to be an easy exercise. We're going to be done in half a year. But then in all these years, it turned out this is not the case. And then about a year ago, I thought that maybe we should just kind of step back and instead of doing trial and error, kind of experimentations in the large dollar limit, we should do our homework and instead go to the dollar and go to zero limit and try a simple toy model which captures all the essential features that George was telling us about. And so the requirement for the toy model that I was looking for is
the number of people who are in that limit always large.
So there are a number of requirements that a model should have in order to mimic all these difficulties. Of course, first is it should be asymptotically free. And it should have a parameter that if I dial that parameter, I go from confinement to walking, and then to conformal. And then in the gauge theory, this would be I go from below the conformal window, I like walking, and then I go inside the conformal window. And the third requirement is that preferably it should be a bosonic system, because then it's cheap, and it should be a two-dimensional system, because then it's even cheaper. And actually, I thought initially that this would be a very simple thing to come up with a model like that. But I only found one. And I hope one outcome of this little short talk will be that somebody, experts in two-dimensional conformal field theories, will give me more models which have this property. But the one I found was the two-dimensional O3 model with a theta term. And the reason this looks like working, is that at theta equals zero, we all know that this is a theory which has a running coupling which looks like that, like QCD, like a toy model. It has been a toy model from QCD for a long time. And at theta equals pi, there is a conjecture by Haldane that, I'll say a few words why this is conjectured to be the case, but anyway, the conjecture is that this theory, at theta equals pi, has...
It's a gauge theory,
right? No, it's a scalar, O3 model.
Sigma model,
yes. So the S is integral d to x, d mu, SA, d mu, SA, and S length is 1, and we have three components. And in this two-dimensional, with the 3 here, they're dependent integers of logical time.
And there are instant bonds.
And so the conjecture at theta equals pi is that this theory has an inverse fixed point. So then the running of the coupling would be something like this. And that's great, because if I change theta, then if I accept this conjecture, then if I change theta to something like pi minus epsilon, then I will have exactly walking.
But just by continuity in theta.
So the movie for the beta function would be like this. This is at theta equals 0. This at theta equals pi minus epsilon. And at theta equals pi, it will probably touch the line, and there will be an inverse fixed point.
So that's why it looked like a good model to study. It has all the features we want. And let me say a few words why this is conjectured to be the case at theta equals pi. Haldane's conjecture goes like, if one considers quantum spin chains, spin S, quantum spin chains, then if you do large S expansion, then Haldane said that this would map to exactly this O3 sigma model with theta equals 2 pi s.
But this is just in the largest limit. And it is known by the thermodynamic beta result that s equals a half quantum spin chain is massless. And so if we accept that the largest expansion is valid all the way down to s equals a half,
then we will get that at theta equals pi, that's a massless theory, so that's more formal, and that's why it's strongly believed that at theta equals pi, you have this one.
That's the only evidence?
Well, that's the origin of the conjecture, and then there are all sorts of numerical checks, but let's say not totally conclusive.
Isn't that an integrable model?
Sorry?
Is it not an integrable model?
Well, that's the thing, that at theta equals zero, this is integrable, even finite volume fractions are exactly known. And at theta equals pi, a priori you don't know. But if you accept that there is a conformal field theory here, you have all kinds of arguments what this conformal field theory is. It's the SU2 WZ and W model at WZ and W model at k equals 1. And this is, of course, integrable. But then you have to accept that this model is the same as that model. And at theta equals non-zero and non-pi, it's not integrable. And of course, the first condition is satisfied because the theta that doesn't appear in perturbation theory, so all thetas will be asymptotically free. It's bosonic, two-dimensional, great. And so this is also satisfied.
What are the arguments exactly at theta equals pi touches and not crossing?
Exactly. That's what I also wanted to say. I wanted to say at the end that this is a toy model which mimics some features but not all features, because in the gauge theory, as George was saying, it crosses. It looks like that. But this model will never do that, unfortunately, because there's a symmetry, theta goes to minus theta, and theta goes to theta plus 2 pi. And because of this symmetry, the theory at pi minus epsilon and pi plus epsilon, they are the same. And if they are the same, neither of them have a fixed point, because neither of them have theta equals pi. So the movie is really, it goes towards this fixed point, but then turns away at theta minus epsilon, and touches it at theta at pi, and then it has to go back just where it came from at theta plus epsilon,
because these two theories are the same.
So that's why, unfortunately, this is not really the best toy model, because it will never have this crossing feature. It will just touch, so it will be a double zero of the beta function. But anyway, it's still good enough. And then when I was first thinking about it, I thought, okay, great, let's just study this model. It should be easy. But then some old story came back, which, I mean, for me it was new, but I guess for many of you it's old. That in this model, two-dimensional O3 sigma model, there is a problem with theta and the topological charge operator. And so let me say briefly what the problems are with theta and the topological charge operator in this model. So the first problem was noted, I don't know, 30 years ago, and the topological charge susceptibility, Q squared over V, this is not a well-defined quantity, unfortunately. And there are several ways to see that. First is the semi-classical approximation. There will be contribution of instantons of size rho. Maybe like this. In the CP n minus 1 model, these contributions go like d rho, rho, n minus 3 probably. So then equals, so CP1 model is the same as this model. And so small instantons give a divergence in this quantity. And really, if you just do a lattice calculation, you say you don't worry about semi-classical approximation, you just do a lattice calculation. Take the continuum limit, you will really see that this Q squared over V diverges. So it doesn't really have a continuum limit. And there are other quantities of this type where this can be observed, that Q, any kind of power, diverges. All powers are, of course, zero. This is not a lattice problem. It's not that we are not doing lattice calculation well enough. This is a property of a continuum theory. And if you do a semi-classical analysis, there is no lattice anywhere, and you can see this as well. And so, but as I said, at that theta equals zero, this is an exactly solvable model. So what do people who do these exact solutions, what do they say? Well, they say that they can compute things like the charge density correlation function exactly. And then you would simulate this on a lattice, get answers, and they are exactly the same as the exact solutions give. So it looks like the topological charge density is an OK object. This is finite in the continuum limit. But when you integrate, then you get a total charge. That's when things become problematic. And this led many people to believe. This led many people to believe that the total topological charge is just not an OK operator, and the only resolution they could think of is that at the total topological charge inserted any correlation function is zero. So just if you define it correctly, somehow it will be zero. And that's how all these infinities will drop out. But then what this means, so people who took this approach, but the charge density inserted into correlation function is non-zero. And this could be a possibility, why not? But then what this means is that theta is actually an irrelevant parameter. And in principle, it's possible. I mean, we write down an operator. It looks like naively like a relevant operator, but then non-perturbatively it might turn out to be irrelevant. So this is a possibility. Just because by taking derivative with respect to theta, we get stuff like this. If it's at zero, then actually in the continuum theory, nothing depends on theta. And then all the theories at various thetas, they are the same. Which would mean that Halley's conjecture is incorrect. And that's and that would be kind of bad news for using this model as a toy model. So instead of just going and simulating this model to see all this nice walking, conformal, and so on, I thought first maybe let's just determine whether theta is an irrelevant parameter or a relevant parameter. And this exercise guess what to do by again doing semi-classical approximation, dilute gas approximation, dilute gas of instantons, because then what one wants to study is the partition function at theta, e to the minus v free energy at theta, and because of the theta goes to minus theta symmetry, this f theta can be fully expanded like this. Only cosines appear from 1 to 0. And then it turns out that in the dilute gas approximation, f1 is coming from the from really dilute gas of instantons. And all the higher ones, fn larger than 1, they are coming from interactions of instantons. So the corrections to diluteness. And the problematic instantons are those that are larger, much larger than the lattice spacing. And that's why this is not a lattice artifact. This is not a lattice problem, because they are really much larger than lattice spacing, but smaller than the much smaller than the correlation length, or in other words, the inverse mass gap. And these instantons, in the semi-classical picture, they have this property. So these are the ones that give a divergence in the first one. But the instanton size divided by the average separation goes to zero in the continuum. So the problematic instantons, which give a divergence in the semi-classical picture into the F1, are really dilute. Because of this, so they don't overlap so much. And if that's the case, then this whole semi-classical analysis tells us that the problematic instantons are weakly interacting. So the higher FNs, which are coming from the interaction of instantons, they will not give a divergence there, because the problematic instantons are dilute. And so that's why the semi-classical analysis tells us, or suggests, that only one parameter is divergent in the free energy, and that one parameter is F1, the first one, and the rest is probably finite, as long as the semi-classical picture is correct. And so this is the starting working hypothesis that I have. And then so I thought that let's look for quantities, and let's measure those totally non-perturbatively, which do not contain F1, only contain the higher F's. And if they only contain the higher F's, then I can check whether they are finite or not, and whether they are non-zero or zero. And if they are finite and non-zero, then certainly all the F's are finite, and then the theta has to be a relevant operator. I mean, the Q has to be a relevant operator. So let's look at good quantities of which have this property. Let's take the Taylor coefficient of the free energy at theta equals zero. And by the way, when I got to this point, I was really surprised that, I mean, this model is like 30 years old. Why is it that I have to work out all these things when people were studying this for even more, for 40 years? But actually, I couldn't really get answers from even from exact solution people. So anyway, if you take the Taylor coefficients, and then you take the difference between two neighboring ones, then this will be just taking derivatives on this Fourier series. It's Fn times n squared minus 1 times n to the power 2n. And so you see, that's the trick, that if I take a difference here, the n equals 1 term drops out, because here is n squared minus 1. So exactly this quantity is free of the F1. So then the working assumption is that this quantity is universal, has a finite continuum limit. So this is the assumption I would like to check. So let's look at the first couple of them.
You don't need to take the difference. So all higher would give you some. You can check semi-classically that all higher chi's will not be divergent.
But they are divergent. So this chi is divergent because you take this derivative, and then this series, this is a cosine here. You take whatever derivative, F1 will stay there. All chi's are divergent. Because the all chi's have an F1 in them, so all chi's are divergent. And that's why you need to take a difference.
But you don't measure F, you measure some multi-point function.
Now wait a second, so let me just write down what I'm measuring. Example, so this is what I call delta chi 2m. And delta chi 2, for instance, you take all these derivatives from the free energy, it will be some, as you say, it's some higher point function of the charge operator. This is the first one. This is the next one, chi. This is the fourth minus the third, q squared minus q 6 plus 15 q to the 4 q squared minus 30 q squared cube divided by v, and so on.
All connected parts, right?
Exactly. It's kind of, because this is kind of like a coulomb, and then exactly kind of connected stuff. And so then we can see what will be kind of a numerical problem, is that all these things are divergent. Everything here is divergent, but exactly the coefficients are such in the plus minuses, so this gigantic cancellation, finally giving a finite answer. And that's why it's going to be a little bit tricky. But anyway, these are well-defined quantities, totally well-defined. And actually, this is the reason why these exact solution people told me that for them to compute this is difficult because they can compute exactly things like qx, q0, two-point function, but for this, these guys, you would need at least a four-point function, even higher, like a six-point function. Mm-hmm. And with thermodynamic beta on Zatzin's Y system, it's kind of an exact solution, but more you know, solving integral equations, and they become complicated for four-point functions and six-point functions. So anyway, this was my goal. Check whether this is finite, and this is finite and not zero. This is important because it might turn out that this whole thing is zero, and then I don't get the result. So let's take a continuum limit, and the continuum limit is, of course, in a finite box. Finite box fixed in a physical units. This is the mass gap at L. L times the mass gap, let me fix this to 4. I could fix it to anything I want. That would be just a different finite size. And then, I mean, it's just the way these lattice calculations go. You take a couple of lattice volumes, 60, 80, all the way to 800. Then you can already see that it's really a great fun for a gauge theory person. Because in QCD you never have something like 800 to the lattice, but here you can have 800 to the square lattice easily. And then you tune the bare couplings at each of them differently, such that the L times the mass gap is always 4. And so once you have that, then you just compute these quantities. And then you can plot the result. The lattice spacing is, in a dimensionless way, it's A over L. So here you could put like from 1 over 60 to 1 over 800, and then you compute this delta chi 2, delta chi 4. And here I had like 12 lattice spacings, which is again kind of a good feeling coming from a gauge theory. You never have something like 12 lattice spacings. You have like 3 or 4 or 5, but here you can really make a beautiful continuum extrapolation, and another one for the other quantity, and you just see that it's beautifully extrapolating to finite values. But I couldn't go over chi over these two because the cancellation here is enormous. And after a while, I mean, even for this plot, we need something like 10 to the 8 configurations. But that's okay, because it's a two-dimensional system. But going higher is just errors explode because of the large cancellations.
These position errors are quadratic?
Well, that's the thing. It's a good question. The discretization errors are in principle quadratic, but there are large logarithmic corrections. And the logarithmic corrections actually make it, if you look at it by eye, It doesn't really look like quadratic, but if you include all the logarithmic corrections into the a squared,
if the error bars are correct, whatever is the behavior, it's clear that it converges to a constant.
That's the other thing I wanted to say. So first, there are two things. If you want to make a very precise continuum extrapolation, you of course need to worry about what the functional form is. And actually, it's known. It's a squared with logarithmic corrections, and it gives a very good chi squared and so on. So everything is great. But the other thing is that you don't really want to know what this value is precisely. All you want to know is whether it extrapolates to a zero or non-zero or diverges. And so even without extrapolating, just the data is very beautiful that it goes to a constant value.
This is done for theta equals zero.
Theta equals zero, of course. Everything is a theta equals zero, yes?
I have some questions about things.
Like, okay.
How do you define Q on the lattice?
Yeah, so that's also a good question. In gauge theory, it's not entirely trivial, but in a spin model like this, you can give a definition which is always integer, even a finite lattice spacing. It's kind of straightforward. But you take four vectors, and then they have some little sphere. If you add those up and divide by 4 pi, and you do this, all the whole lattice is always an integer.
Okay. Another question is, if you go to non-zero theta, then there should be program.
Exactly. So that's where I will go towards the end. Until now, everything is equal zero. Until now, everything is theta equals zero. You take the derivatives and theta equals zero. But I would say a few words about the sign problem you mentioned. So What did I want to say? Oh yeah, so then all these delta chi's are finite, but of course they depend on this, they depend on the finite size of the box, which is sometimes called z. So I computed this for one particular value,
4,
but I'd like to ask from exact solution people if perhaps if they could give me what is the Euclidean limit of this thing. Probably it's finite too. So that's a question or a homework for people. I don't know how to compute this, but maybe somebody else who is expert in thermodynamic rate and all that.
But since you now know the first two terms in series, you try to get to plot your Fourier series and try to see how far in theta you can go.
But I mean, no, it's not that we have these f2, f3 separately, because you see, these are derivatives of f. But the f, so the derivatives of free energy, but the f's are Fourier coefficients, not Taylor. So these are all sorts of sums of the fn coefficients. So it's not that I have like f2 itself or f3 or f4. I have these special sums in involving them. But otherwise, you're correct. We have some information about the capital F's. Okay. So the main message is that with this exercise, one could prove that theta is a relevant coupling non-perturbatively, and so the topological charge is a relevant operator. So that's great. So now we can really go to our original goal of simulating at theta non-zero, because that's where we want to see walking and conformal and so on. But then, as you said, there's a time problem, but that's actually not a terribly big problem, because in these models there are algorithms called cluster algorithms, and they exactly give you an exponential increase in statistics, which can exactly beat the exponentially bad time problem. So it's actually doable. Of course, the larger you take theta, and the larger the volume you want to take, the worse it will get. So I'm not saying that for all volumes it will be possible, but anyway, for quite large range of theta and moderate volumes, it's definitely doable, and it works. So I think that's what I wanted to say. Let me mention one more question. Actually, it was asked by Ethan.
So it was done or not done?
Well, I mean, so it was not done, but it's on. This part is the ongoing thing.
Maybe I should say it's ongoing in several places.
Yeah.
Okay. This is the only model that several people have come up with, so several groups are working on this.
Sure. Okay. So Ethan asked me, I think, a pretty good question. I didn't know the answer.
So let me repeat this here. It's that, so if you take theta equals pi minus epsilon, then it's going to be walking.
And in the gauge theory case, there's really a physical sense to these two scales. One is the extended technicolor scale, and the other one is the technicolor scale. And I don't know how, in this single model, with this particular theta, how one would physically define these two scales. But that would be really great if there would be some physical way of saying that there is one scale, there is another scale, and then we could take this ratio, which would be a totally physical quantity, and then we could see that this goes to zero as theta goes to pi. But I don't know how to really give a definition, but that would be really great.
If you want somebody to jump in,
yeah,
it seems like it should be straightforward. So lambda 1 is the scale where the infrared fixed point at theta equals pi no longer characterizes the physics well.
Right.
That's just another way of saying it's.
Well, inverse, it's clear. But do you know? Can you give an operator or something, some concrete dimensionable or something, from which I can extract lambda one, take another one from which I can extract lambda two, some very specific operators. That's not so easy, I think.
That's not the way you phrased it to begin with. But
all right, I want to phrase it this way.
Extract that lambda from
correlation
functions if you really had them measured accurately at all scales, but that's...
This is easier. Lambda 2, I don't have a good way of...
You're saying this theory has a mass gap. That's the scale of the mass gap.
That's the lambda 1.
No, that's the lambda 2.
No, lambda 1...
Oh, sorry. Yeah, you're right. This is the easier one.
Yeah. Well, that's the scale of which universality breaks down, where you see corrections to universal scale.
Mm-hmm.
So you'd assume that below lambda 1, but before lambda 2, all of the scaling is determined by just the anomalous dimension of one relevant operator. And so lambda 1 is at the scale at which the next anomalous dimension starts to contribute significantly. And it's presumably non-universal, so it contributes different to different observables.
Yeah.
So that would be some definition of the scale.
But then, kind of operationally, I mean, what would you?
I think compute the correlation function of a bunch of different variables and see when you see departures from the universality and scale a bunch of different observables.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, sounds good.
Like Lagrange, or between sigma squared or something like this, correlator between lambda one and lambda two, there is no running. Say then through the power. By power, and then
after that
exponential.
Okay. Something like that. And just one more mention, kind of homework, is that somebody should really. I think such a two-dimensional model should exist, which doesn't have this little problem that the beta function really just touches the axis and it doesn't go through. So this model doesn't do this. Whereas the gauge theory does this, and actually David Kaplan wrote a paper how these two theories could be related, and what the relationship, and so on, in the gauge theory. And then he would say, he was saying, so why don't we study this thing in a gauge theory? And I thought, come on, we don't even know how to study this region, it's totally hopeless to study three zeros of the beta function in a four-dimensional gauge is totally hopeless. But if you would have a two-dimensional bosonic model similar to this one, which had this property, where the zero goes away this way, then we could perhaps study this question. So into this list, the fourth requirement is that the beta function should have a single zero. I mean, so meaning that it goes through linearly, single zero, but two of them. And if somebody could cook up a two-dimensional model like that, that would be great.
Quantum mechanical model in that paper that has this feature. Some potential on the large.
Yeah, but I mean, if it's not.
And then depending on the tuning, it goes.
But it's not like a asymptotically free field theory.
But it's still. One thing they could ask is.
Thank you for your attention.
Sorry, you don't. you don't know. Actually, it could be that at that double zero, there's a new relevant coupling. And so, basically, maybe you're losing the critical surface. At this point, you're somehow imagining you're staying on the critical surface, but maybe at that point, the critical surface is redefined by some new relevant coupling. And so you would have to tune to stay on the critical surface, and then you might see the beta function crossing. No, it's like basically the beta function is crossing, it's just going
in another direction.
So you have
that's true.
So I would say get to the zero and then look for some new marginal or operator.
Yeah.
one comment on the numerical part is that even in the case where you know the answer when theta is equal to pi, then you know you have an infrared fixed, or you trust this conjecture, Haldane conjecture, which has been verified so many times.
No, it has not been really verified.
With spin chains, it has been verified many times.
For spin and a half.
For spin and a half.
Integer versus half integer spins.
But that includes the large spin expansion. In order for you to say that this is related to the sigma model, for that you need the large spin expansion of this quantum spin chain. And so that's the part where it's same kind of a conjecture. All right, but anyway, so let's accept it, yes?
My comment is, even when you fix theta to be equal to pi and you measure the running coupling, then what you see is that there are logarithmic corrections to the approach to the fixed point, and showing that there is a fixed point is exceedingly difficult, even in that case.
Sure, yeah, definitely.
And it's even more difficult to measure the running coupling when theta is not equal to pi, because then the sign problem is much more difficult to control. So, good luck.
Yeah, just as a comment on that, so you focused on the theta slightly less than pi case.
Yeah.
But for the theta equals pi case, it would be really interesting if you could verify this, not just that there is a fixed point, but that it flows to this particular conformal field theory.
Yeah, so I think what Philip was mentioning, that some numerical evidence exists for that, at theta equals pi, but that's, so at a fixed, so the status of the numerical evidence is that they would simulate at the fixed lattice spacing, actually large lattice spacing, and then they would go to large volumes, they would look at scaling, and they would get the same exponents as the anomalous dimensions in the WZ and W model at k equals 1. So they say, all right, so this is evidence. But of course, you need to take a quantitative limit there, and so on, and so on, and so on. But it's pretty convincing. Not complete, but convincing, yes.
Mortal Tent? Okay.